Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is from Yorkshire. She worked as a bookseller and for the charity Quick Reads. When she was a teenager, her younger brother was knocked over by a car and lived on in a persistent vegetative state for 8 years until a judge agreed his feeding tube should be withdrawn so that he could die. The Last Act of Love is her best-selling book about that time, and she's now followed it with A Manual for Heartache, How to Feel Better. It's a survival guide, and it reminds us all that we're not alone. Cathy Rensenbrick, welcome to Meet the Writers. You've worked extensively in the book trade. You've been books editor at The Bookseller, project director at the charity Quick Reads. You've also had stints at The Reading Agency and Waterstones. But it's the events of your teenage years when you worked at the Bell and Crown Inn, the pub run by your parents, that formed the main part of your first book, The Last Act of Love. And I wondered if you could take us back to that time and tell us what happened.
I could take us all back to 1989. It feels like a long time ago, doesn't it? So in 1989, we moved into this pub in a village called Snaith in Yorkshire. It was very exciting, because if you've never lived in a pub that your parents own, I can tell you, you have a high old time.
Because you were born originally in Cornwall, weren't you?
That's right, yes. Born in Cornwall, and my dad was working in the tin mines. They closed down, and we went up north so that he could work on Selby Coalfield. And then, I think it was his 40th birthday, he'd so nearly been killed at work many times over the course of his life, and he had another near miss and just thought, that's it, I've used up all my lives. And the pub in the next village to ours came up for sale. We managed to buy it. So it was highly exciting. We moved in. And then the following summer, by this time I'm 17 and my brother Matty is 16. And I mean, I just did adore him. He was a great giant of a boy. He was 6'4". So he was 9 inches taller than me and 13 months younger than me. And we had a sort of a glorious, jokey, knockabout relationship. And then one night he was knocked over a couple of miles from the pub. And I wasn't there, but I was there very soon afterwards. And I remember kneeling in the road by his unconscious body and just so desperately wanting him to be okay. And then an ambulance came and I went with him to the hospital. When I look now at my life as a whole, that was the guillotine moment, really, the moment at which everything changed.
Because, of course, you'd both been at the same event that night and you'd just left earlier.
Yes, we'd been out. There was a pool hall called The Rainbow. It doesn't exist anymore. And we'd been out. There was a late night disco thing there. So we'd both been there. And one of our customers had asked me if I'd wanted a lift home. And I just said yes. And I went to get him to see if he wanted to come. And he said no. And he said, I might get lucky. And he sort of grinned at me in the arrogant way that he sometimes did. And, of course, I then walked out of the place, and that was the last time I saw him with a functioning brain. And he never got lucky again in any way.
You obviously then had to tell your parents and all of you go back to the hospital. I wonder at what point it became clear that actually he wasn't going to get better.
Well, it was years, and it's still the most difficult thing. Having written a book about it and then lots of articles and talking about it all the time, I still really struggle to track that erosion from, well, first of all, utter conviction that he would get better, because I think we all thought, me and my parents, we thought love could conquer all, which, you know, it doesn't, actually, always. And then very gradual erosion then of hope into despair over a period of some years. And it was 4 or 5 years before I said to my parents that I thought perhaps it might have been better for him to have died and maybe we should do something about trying to make that so. But I think it was probably, I think after a couple of years, I did know. I had my first kind of major depressive episode a couple of years in, and I didn't realise it at the time, but I now think that was all tied up with just not wanting to face the reality of knowing that he shouldn't be alive like he was, and just refusing, you know, not wanting to accept that reality. So I now think I probably started to twig then. It was 4 or 5 years before I allowed myself to have that thought out loud. It's a very transgressive thing to desire the death of someone you love.
And of course, while all this was going on and while he was in hospital and later at home, your life was carrying on. You had to do all the normal things.
Yeah.
And you had to go to university and all of that. You'd leave home and have all the normal experiences that a teenage girl has. You were drinking heavily at one point.
Yes, I was. At all points, really. Up until about 18 months ago. Yes, I was, which to a certain extent seemed fairly normal in our culture. Of course, I can see now that I compared myself to the customers of our pub, so possibly not the wisest thing to... I never really thought I had a drinking problem. I didn't drink as much as some of the people I knew. But yes, I did drink heavily. And at one point that was social and not particularly unusual. I mean, I drank a lot at university, but again, not hugely. And lots of English people drank a lot at university, so I wasn't majorly out of the step. The older I got, and it took me a long time to realise, the more gradually I realised that actually the people around me had stopped drinking or stopped drinking so much. And I came to see eventually that I needed to part ways with alcohol, which I must say has been a very successful thing for me. I'm a very happy, sober person now. Mm-hmm.
So at one point you then decide that you need to bring Matty home mm-hmm. to the pub. But for that to happen, you need to completely reorganise the way the building's laid out. Mm-hmm. And that was hugely problematic.
Yes, that was difficult. So, of course, the pub was just an old building, originally, I think, from 17th century. It had been built onto over the years, but just two stories. So Matty used to come home from hospital. It makes him sound active saying it, like, we used to bring him home from hospital and have him above the pub, and we used to lift him up the pub stairs. I think it's called the Australia lift. I mean, nurses aren't allowed to do it now. But we used to lift him up the stairs. I mean, it was horrendously dangerous, really. And then occasionally it would happen that he would have a huge epileptic fit above the pub and the ambulance would come, and then they'd have to sort of stretcher him down the stairs. So eventually we thought, well, if we want to have him home permanently, which we did, because basically nowhere else wanted him. He hadn't made any progress. He couldn't go to a rehabilitation centre because there was basically nothing to rehabilitate. And we just didn't want him to be left alone on a ward in hospital. We wanted to bring him home and have him live around us and, you know, look after him. So we built this bungalow extension. But that was all very peculiar because the council had decided they wanted to turn... We built it on our car park, on our land, but the council had decided they wanted to turn that into a public car park. So they did a compulsory purchase order and then they wouldn't give us the land back. It was all actually quite ridiculous and Kafkaesque, really. And then eventually our local MP got involved and we were able to do it. But it was an odd time because it did feel that, I think when something so catastrophically terrible happens to you, it can be surprisingly difficult then. Bureaucratic struggles. I think we just didn't understand why people couldn't see what we needed to do and why people were being difficult and obstructive and unhelpful.
And they were like that too when the decision, the very painful decision as it must have been to let him die happened, because you then had to fight for that right too.
Yes, we had to go to court, which is just no longer necessary in every case. But we had to go, I think we were the 12th case. And I mean, all the people involved were actually very courteous, but still the whole process was awful. I still feel upset when I think about it. I had to write an affidavit saying that I wanted him to die, and it was just such a horrible thing to have to do, and I just couldn't find the words for it. And just the thing of having to go, we had to go down to London to do it, and of course we looked like a pub family from Yorkshire on a day trip to London, surrounded by all these lawyers, you know, all these sort of posh people in suits. So it was quite disorientating. Linford Christie was in the court next to us. There'd been some libel case. And I remember my dad saying, my dad's a funny man. He's Irish and he has this great sense of dark humour. And I remember my dad saying, because there were all these press and they were there for Linford Christie, of course, but we walked by them. My dad said about Linford Christie, he said, well, he said, if he's going to the same place, he'll get there first. And we had this sort of sad little laugh, because I think sometimes I think it's at times like that where there were times when if we hadn't managed to find a little joke, if we hadn't managed to find a little bit of release, I just think I might have just died on the spot, just spontaneously combusted with the horror of it all, really.
Because it is hugely depressing. I wonder how you separate, when you're depressed, the circumstantial from the chemical in that way. Obviously, you had every reason to be depressed.
I mean, I think that's a lifelong puzzle for me. I still wonder about that. Because, of course, one of the things about being depressed for me, the way I become depressed, is that my worldview becomes very bleak. And I find it very difficult to find hope in any situation. So it's difficult if I'm in a situation where that it is bleak. It's difficult to separate out the strands. I often find it difficult to work out what's an appropriate emotional response to what I'm experiencing. I mean, I don't think I was depressed at that time. I mean, usually for me, and I know everybody's like this, for me, I'm very good in the crisis, and then it's usually afterwards that everything goes a bit haywire. Mm. But something about needing to do things It might just be as simple as body chemistry helping me out. But somehow, I would recommend myself as a friend in need. I'm extremely good in a crisis. But then I really have to look after myself afterwards, because it's then that I'll have problems.
So this book is a beautiful memoir. It's absolutely heartbreaking, but really tells the story. And I would urge listeners to read it themselves. And you examine so many issues, which you come back to again in your next book, which is A Manual for Heartache. We all do what we can to cope, but this new book is about how to cope when the worst happens. Is it the book that you wished you'd had?
I think so. And I think that's probably why I wrote it. I felt I learned so much after writing my first book. I mean, I learned things by writing it, but it was really the way people responded to it. And then people told me their own stories. And questions that people asked me that made me really want to write the second book was, people would say to me things like, what advice could anybody have given you then? What might have helped? What made things different? I remember one really nice woman said to me, you know, did you have to spend 20 years being drunk and depressed? Or could someone have helped you with the aftermath? And I thought, actually, I think I do have things to share. Possibly specifically for young women who find themselves in a state of trauma, but not even necessarily that. I hear from all sorts of people who have found the book useful. But that's what I set out to do. I wanted to try to write something useful and something kind. Because actually, sometimes I think when things are awful, a little bit of kindness goes quite a long way, doesn't it? So I wanted to write a friendly, approachable, like a non-professional book, you know, not the sort of advice you'd get from the doctor. And not, I sort of think of it myself as just a fellow traveller who's just a little further down the pathway.
It's so difficult, though, to know how to talk about it, isn't it? I too have a dead sibling. And what do you say when people say, how many brothers and sisters do you have? Well, I take the coward's way out. I say a brother. I don't say a brother and a sister, but the sister died. And then you have to go into the whole kind of thing, do you? I mean, it's very difficult. What do you say?
Well, of course, one of the things about writing a book about my brother is that in some ways, I almost think I did it to keep myself on the record, to stop myself pretending that he didn't exist and that he hadn't existed, to restore him to the appropriate place in my own personal history. In the nicest possible way now, I kind of can't escape him. My son's called Matthew, and he was Googling me, and he went to Google Images, and he showed me Google Images. And if you do that, if you look at the images of me, so many images of me also have my brother in them. It's the cover of the book, it's the pictures. And I sort of feel really happy about that, because, of course, I don't have him in my actual life, but something about me feels very happy that his importance to my life is now kind of inescapable. I mean, I'm not convinced it wouldn't be a bit psychologically healthier for me to not be quite so linked to him, but I make efforts with that. I do feel he slightly talks to me, by which I don't mean I don't know what it means. It may well be that it's just in my head. But when he talks to me, the thing he's saying is stuff like, oh, would you just get a life of your own? Stop being obsessed with me. Stop it. Stop it. Sometimes when people ask me to, you know, write things about him, or if there's an opportunity to do something that's very much related to him, it's like I almost hear his voice in my head saying, no, don't do it. Go do something else. But of course, it's so, given that I can't have his actual voice, I do love that I have his voice in my head. That seems to me to be such a brilliant privilege, and I wouldn't ever want to be without it. I think in terms of how you explain yourself to people, it's social embarrassment, really, isn't it? In a really funny way, it is easier once you've written a memoir about your dead sibling to talk about your dead sibling, because having the fact that you've written a book about it slightly makes your grief a bit more respectable than if you're just, you know, if you're just in the street and someone asks you about, have you got any brothers and sisters? And then I'm sort of crying and saying, I never forget him. That's worse than being in a radio studio talking about my memoir and saying, I'll never forget him.
Yeah. I mean, because there is, as you tell people, really the etiquette of death.
Yeah.
Importantly, what not to say.
There used to be all these rules about how to behave, and a lot of them were from the church. And to a certain extent, in our increasingly secular society, we haven't really replaced our need for etiquette, our need for ritual, I think, around death. So it's a bit of a free-for-all at the moment, and nobody quite knows what to do. And then I think sometimes it's often a very well-meaning attempt to say something. People do rather blunder in. So I did in A Manual for Heartache sort of tell a few examples of peculiar things to say. I remember a friend of mine who had suffered a tragedy of biblical proportions. And the first time she saw her next-door neighbour afterwards, he reached out his hands and said, it comes to us all. And she said she just thought, like, not quite like that, it doesn't. And I think often people, I do this, I want to, in my eagerness to sort of show people they're not alone, I want to find common ground with them. But of course, that's awful, because that's what happens when someone's child has died and then everybody they meet tells them some dead child anecdote. Mm. Often like at some remove, you know. Mm. Oh, yes, well, the teacher at my sister's school, she has this brother and he's a postman and his child died. And people will do that to people in the street. So I think that sometimes just sort of calming down and being physically present and not running away, of course. My dad always remembers that people would cross the street rather than have to talk to him. Mm. So I don't, you know, don't be a street crosser.
You're talking about children dying, and there is a kind of hierarchy in death, isn't there? I mean, some deaths have more weight than others. For instance, a child, it would seem, the public perception of course, it's always a huge tragedy to the people left behind.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I tried to give I think there's a whole hierarchy of suffering. I try to edge out of it, obviously, because I think that if it's important to you, the person who suffered it, then it's important. Mm. I hear from quite a lot of people, especially around the first book, people would sort of say to me, like, oh, you know, is it okay for me to enjoy your book and find it useful for my dilemma because I haven't suffered as much as you? So people say that to me a lot, and I feel I don't want anybody to feel that. But again, I think if you were talking to someone whose child had just died, telling them that you understand how they feel because your granny died last year is maybe not ideal, you know. Mm. I think there's a writer I really like called Julia Samuel, who's a psychotherapist, and she has a wonderful book called Grief Works. She talks about a death out of time. And I think that is a distinction. I think death, you know, we shouldn't be frightened of death. It's very natural. It will happen to us all, certainly. And we will all know death. There is an extra brutality about a death that happens out of time, out of the natural order of things. Mm. And then that brings different challenges, really, to the people then that are left behind trying to deal with that.
And there are challenges, too, for deaths that have come in their time. My mother recently died. Mm. She was very old, and there's quite a lot of guilt associated with that, thinking, I think it's probably time for you to go now. She wasn't enjoying her life.
I think that's entirely true. And also, because I've reached the age now where my peers' parents are dying, and I've really noticed how it doesn't make it at all easier. See, when I was younger, I would have thought this. It doesn't make it at all easier if you don't have a good relationship with the parent that dies. That seems to be particularly difficult. So it seems to be a theme. I seem to know several men whose fathers have died and they didn't have a good relationship with their father. But the death of the separated father has been a huge life event that then has caused them a lot of difficulty in their own relationships and with their own children, possibly especially their sons. So, but then, again, I would come back to, like, what else is life for other than to learn these things, really? I think there's this slight modern promise that we are slightly told that perfection is only the next purchase away, isn't it? But of course, what life really is, I have come to see, is a journey from innocence to experience. And a lot of that experience we won't want and we won't ask for, but it is part of being human.
And very difficult to deal with. I mean, we're talking about sort of etiquette of death too. When my mother died, we really tried to have a euphemism-free death and not use all of those phrases, had a good innings, gone to better things, a new star in heaven, and all of that stuff. But we fall back on this time and again because it's just useful to have these phrases you can trot out.
It is, and I certainly find with kids, when I talk to children, stuff comes out of my mouth. You know, I mean, like, you know, even over, you know, when the hamster died, found myself accidentally, like, and if somebody said to me, you know, if I had to have an intellectual opinion about how you should discuss the death of his hamster with your child, I would not have done it like this. But accidentally, I just painted this a beautiful picture of hamster heaven. And because, of course, again, when you're talking with a child, you're balancing the desire for honesty, which I really have with my child, but also this terrible thing of how, you know, how do we help these children on their journey from innocence to experience and sort of the desire to protect? I actually think what any death needs is it needs a great deal of people giving themselves and each other the benefit of the doubt. And it needs extraordinary amounts of compassion. And that's the main thing you need. And a sort of a flexibility. Because the other thing, as I do, I think, say in my book, you can't give a blueprint because, of course, everybody's different. And a friend of mine whose mother died fairly recently, you know, the thing she wanted was someone that she could sort of tell jokes with and have a bit of a laugh with. And she was exhausted by being the good daughter at the hospice, which she was. But what she wanted from me was larks and jokes and a bit of light relief. And sometimes someone might want that from you and it's okay. Or you might be their secret keeper. You know, you might be their sort of safe place. And I think that, I'm not going to sound too Pollyanna, it's slightly being alive to the possibility of doing good deeds as well, I think. And also, there will be some times when people want to be left right alone and don't want to have to talk about it. And other times when they could probably do with a bit of a hand. Mm. I think practical stuff's really good, actually. If I ever know anyone in need, I'd say to them, like, do you want me to come around and do the ironing or anything? Do you need anything doing? Because I think that's quite hard.
Mm. When you're writing it down, I mean, a lot of it, certainly your first book, relies on memory, and it was quite a long time ago. Mm. How important is it to get those facts exactly right, or is it more just about the feeling?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I teach memoir writing now, and the way I talk about this with my students is I do think of memoir writing, I think it's worth considering the idea of the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So I think if you're going to try and write a memoir about something, you should commit to telling the truth. I have tried to be truthful in my book. I don't think you owe anyone the whole truth. The whole truth is also impossible. It's structurally impossible. It's logistically impossible. But equally, you don't owe it to everyone. You don't have to say everything that happened around it. You can leave stuff out. And then I also think nothing but the truth is kind of what you owe. I don't think you should make up stuff to make you look a little bit better in retrospect. So that's the way I tend to find it. And I tend to think that emotional truth is more important than practical truths. I was aided in writing my memoir because my mum kept very detailed diaries. But again, she didn't write her emotions in them. It's nothing like, I feel really sad that this has happened. It's all about, we had a new hoist delivered. But it meant I knew exactly what happened when. And we had a lot of medical reports. So factually, it meant I could construct the timeline of when things happened. And even though I've written the book, I wouldn't be good at that now. If somebody wanted me to write that down, I probably wouldn't remember. What I do remember with utter conviction and would sort of go to the state for is I remember how I felt at all of those times. Mm. Not necessarily whether something happened in 92 or 95, or whether it was July or whether it was December, but I know what I felt and what I thought. I mean, possibly too much. I've got a new theory, which I'll share with you. I think lots of memoirists have actually got some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, because people say, like, how do you remember that so vividly when it was so long ago? And it's like, because it plays in my head all the time. But I've had really good trauma therapy now, so actually it no longer plays in my head all the time.
I mean, should we be using writing memoir as a cathartic process? Is it a cathartic process?
I think it certainly can be. I think there is great, not quite pleasure, not quite satisfaction, not quite catharsis. There is definitely value to be had in trying to wrestle a very difficult personal narrative onto the page, to have something that's shared. I like working with people in prisons, and that really resonates in prisons because people have often led chaotic lives and they don't know how to explain their experience. Mm. And it always really resonates with them, this idea that if you can't even to yourself explain what's happened to you, then you're kind of looking at chaos. So I think there's, you know, considerable mileage in that. Again, I think it's helpful to separate out writing and publishing, because I think writing a memoir might be cathartic, but I think publishing it isn't. And publishing it is extraordinary and wonderful and brilliant and makes loads of spectacularly good things happen. Quite often talk to memoirists now who are about to go out into the world with a big memoir. And I do say to them, you know, like, if you're not already having therapy, you might find you need one after the publication. Mm-hmm.
A lot of things surrounding death are about ritual. Mm-hmm. And it's really important. We need a grave or a place to go. So the final piece of your puzzle, really, was scattering Matty's ashes.
Mm. So we hadn't picked them up after he was cremated. And again, when I think back to his funeral, it's very fragmented. I mean, I think I was going mad that day, basically. So it's this odd, splintered, sort of filmic memory of very intense episodes through the day. And then for years, every so often, I'd think, I wonder what happened to his ashes. And I just didn't dare ask my parents about it because part of me worried that we had had some kind of ashes ceremony and I'd been too drunk and mad to remember it. So that was a bit of a worry. Also, part of me thought, like, I wonder if they thought I was too drunk and mad to cope, so they might have just, like, chucked them overboard somewhere. And I didn't really want to find that out either. And, of course, by this time in my family, we just didn't like mentioning it because it was such an area of pain for all of us. So I didn't ask for ages. And then over the course of writing the book, I asked my mum and she said they're there at the undertaker's. We never picked them up. And when I got in touch with the undertaker, actually my mum got in touch with the undertaker for me. And again, every step of this was so painful, so hard, so laboured, took so much thought. And then the undertaker told her that it's not uncommon for ashes not to be collected. They have ashes going back 50 years. And again, often a difficult death, a death out of time, the ashes of a child. It's like the final step that people can't bring themselves to do, as it was with us. And then eventually, I wanted to sort of go and pick them up. And then I thought, actually, that decided that is a bit crazy. Because I'm not a very good driver. And I kind of, it began to feel like some funny comic tale that I'd be on the train at Doncaster Station with my package. And again, slightly his voice in my head saying, like, are you mad? Don't pursue this idea. So the undertakers couriered them to us. And then eventually we scattered them off the rocks in Falmouth, which is where my parents met, where I now live again, near where we were born. And we scattered them off the rocks there. And we put a plaque on my granny's grave, which is in Swampool Cemetery. It looks out down over the Swampool Reservoir. And that's lovely. And I go, and again, this might not be unrelated, I then moved house to be live about 20 minutes from my brother's plaque. And I didn't move house to be there, but at some point I realised that that was now what happened and it made me feel very happy. So I walk by it quite often. Sometimes very fast, kind of slightly tipping him a wink, and sometimes I go and have a bit of a sit there. But it has been very good for me to have a place of memory. And I think I'd got confused and thought that because I wasn't religious, I wasn't allowed to have any of these things. But I think now, in general, it tends to be good for us to mourn the dead, to mark their passing. But again, to do that, how not to do it if you don't want to do it, but to have it if you want to.
Having been through all this, do you fear your own death?
No, not at all. I'm remarkably unconcerned by my own death and illness. I fear the death of the people I love, or worse than that, I fear that they won't die, but they'll be left in some horrible condition, and then I won't be strong enough to cope with it. So that's what I fear. But yes, my own death, don't care. I care more than I did. There was this really strange thing that happened to me. So I can't remember now, somewhere around, I think I write about it in the second book, actually. I suddenly became a bit more nervous in alleyways, you know, a bit more nervous on planes. And I realised it was because the first time since my brother's accident, I felt invested in life. So I feel much more invested in life than I used to. And I think it kind of gave me an odd protection in a way. I used to genuinely not care. I didn't want to do anything to make myself not exist, but I quite wanted to not exist. And I don't feel like that anymore. So I feel very committed to life as long as it lasts. But I don't, compared to normal people, I feel really inoculated about caring about it. I fear being depressed, but I don't fear other illnesses.
Mm. And in terms of the future, you have a new book on the way.
I do. I've written a book about books, which has been joyous to write. That will be in October. And that's just been really nice. And I feel that that's sort of the book I was born to write. When my first book was shortlisted for the Wellcome Trust Prize, which is a prize about medical writing, I remember saying to someone there, like, I can promise you guys, I'm never bothering you again. I'm not interested in medical writing. I don't want to have to write about this sort of thing. Whereas my book, that's nothing to do with what I've learned about life because of what happened to my brother. That is my, you know, I think my first identity probably is being a reader. And it has been joyous to do, and I'm writing this quiz for the end of it, like a bookish quiz. I'm just having so much fun, I can't tell you, just making up quiz questions about books and imagining people reading them and like talking about them to their friends. It's just delightful.
Kathy, thank you so much for coming in. The Last Act of Love and A Manual for Heartache are published by Picador, and they're both obviously by Kathy Rensenbrick. And look out for a new book, which is called
Talking to Strangers About Books.
There you go. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, May Lee Evans and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.